This is WJBC This Week.
The exciting point is it opens up the entire development world to say we've got a dream for that property.
When I see a city council saying I'm going to put taxpayer money forward, then I have a question, because I don't think you should be risking my tax dollars.
This is horrible politics. It's not fair to seniors.
When I put my sign up, I meant no offense to any Palestinians. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was humorous.
I would tell everyone that I know to boycott and not to use their services until there's a public apology.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stark. On this week's program, Bloomington weighs its options as a developer wants to tear down four downtown buildings for redevelopment. A sign at a Bloomington business sparked controversy. We'll hear from the creator and a Palestinian who explains why they believe it's offensive. We'll talk to a Bloomington man who was on the Kent State campus at the time of a massacre there 45 years ago this week. Plus, former Redbird James O'Shaughnessy shares his dreams of playing in the NFL now that he's been drafted by the Kansas City Chiefs. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A developer revealed a proposal to the Bloomington City Council this week to tear down four downtown buildings, including Commerce Bank, the Front and Center building, and the former Elks Lodge across the street. The City Council wants to pursue more discussions on the plan. This was the first City Council meeting for new Alderwoman Amelia Burgess, who talked with the WJBC's Dan Sweeney this week.
What is being talked about as far as the development of the two blocks that are right across, basically, from the Coliseum? Is a hotel probably going to go there, and what else would go in that area?
I think at this point in time, we can't really say what probably would happen, and that's because it's been changing over time. Late last year and last fall, the talk centered very much so on a hotel and a desire to move forward on a hotel. And since then, things have changed a little bit. Right now, Kyle Hamm at the Economic Development Council has come in, and he's helping to guide this process more. And he, in cooperation with this developer, have come up with an idea of kind of putting it into two phases now. So phase one would be preparing the property and making it attractive to developers. Phase two would be putting out a request for reduction that may or may not state what the end use would be. It may, one suggestion is to leave it very open-ended to see what kind of creative ideas people would bring to us. Is a hotel a possibility? Yes, of course it is. A lot of people think a hotel could be a very, very successful in downtown Bloomington. Not everyone agrees with that. Other people believe we would be better served by more of a mixed-use facility, some residential, potentially smaller businesses or offices. Right now, the possibilities are still very much open, and I'm hopeful that perhaps we can get some guidance from city staff with regard to what would be the best fit for downtown, not just economically, but in terms of land use.
Let's break it out a little bit here. What is Jeff Gabelhausen, who is the former mayor of East Peoria, what did he want to bring to the table last night?
What he has discussed is a proposal where he has an option to purchase the property. I think that's one thing that needs to be made clear is the property is currently privately owned. So the city has, other than our regulatory apparatus that would apply to any property, we don't have a lot of control with what happens to it. I mean, obviously zoning and property ordinances apply. But what Mr. Gabelhausen has proposed is that he would follow through with his option to purchase, and he would prepare it for potential development. And that could potentially and likely would include demolition of some of the buildings, although that's been a fluid process as he's received feedback from not just the council but the community in terms of the importance of the historic properties there and a request that that be taken into consideration and that preservation be made a priority. And so he would prepare that property. And then before moving forward, though, would have an agreement with the city for the city to purchase it back for some price. Last night, the tentative price he was talking about was $8.2 million. However, exactly what that number entails yet is still being evaluated. It's not just preparing the site. I believe that also includes, to some extent, moving some of the existing businesses that are there because they need to find other locations. But I'm not sure 100% on the details. As I said, things have been changing, and it's now in the city staff's hands.
The $8.2 million, of course, is the number that, to a lot of the people who began giving feedback, kind of stuck in their craw just a little bit when they say it, and this would be good to find an answer from your side how you see it. To get that money, the city would have to either float bonds, go to a bank, get a loan like the rest of us do, things like that. And the city in the last week leading up to this has been talking about teetering on this deficit funding that nobody wants, at least nobody in a lot of the people want in the city. How's the $8.2 million, how would that figure into the city being able to make this deal happen?
Well, that's a large part of the issue here is that amount of money. But I think it's best to look at these two issues. Number one, economic development and how or if the city provides any funding for it. That's number one. But number two is the structural deficit we're dealing with. And that is a recurring problem with just funding essential core city services. And so while they're very, very interrelated, they are somewhat different in terms of capital development or economic development plans. It is generally considered to be very acceptable, even desirable, to put out issue bonds. That is considered to be a responsible way to deal with it. Now, we should not be issuing bonds to make payroll. That would be very irresponsible and unsustainable. So these are both very interrelated issues, and I was very happy to hear that while we're having this discussion about economic development, the mayor also is moving forward with a plan to get our structural deficit under control. And he's talked about last night, he previewed that next week he would be putting forth to the council a proposal for a budget task force to really look at the bigger picture and to get us on a long-term, very viable and economically sustainable financial path. And I'm looking forward to that conversation happening in conjunction with this conversation about economic development.
Amelia Burgess, Bloomington City Council, is with us on the phone. And again, thank you for taking some time. Would the city be willing to go forward with floating bond money or taking a loan out, not knowing if they have somebody on the hook that wants to develop that property first?
You know, I don't know. I think it's a little bit too soon to tell. That is certainly an area of a great deal of concern. A worst-case scenario would be to prepare this property and then to find out, unfortunately, that it wasn't appealing. I find that, big picture-wise, unlikely. The opportunity to for a developer, an investor to come in and to have an entire city block or potentially slightly more to work with is rare in a community of our size and of our economic status. So I think that we've received, we have every indication that this parcel of land will be attractive to people and to developers. The question is, what will the parameters be? And I believe that's part of what staff is going to be looking at as well, trying to predict, okay, if we put out an RFP, what would be the expectations from people who would be attracted to working in this community? And that'll be part of the decision-making process.
That was Bloomington Alderwoman Amelia Burgess with our Dan Swaney. It was meant as a joke, but many who saw the sign weren't laughing. There were calls for protests and boycotts on social media when they saw a sign posted at Checker Cab in Bloomington that said, quote, "Things I trust more than Obama, a Palestinian on a motorcycle." That sign was the creation of Checker Cab owner Aaron Halliday, who talked with the WJBC's Scott Lachlan and Colleen Reynolds this week.
And you saw it and you responded, I saw, to one Facebook post. So we'll let you respond now to these people that are saying you're a racist, it's mean-spirited, and you're going to lose business because of this.
Well, first of all, it's a joke. I'm not a racist. And about 3 weeks ago, I received a message on Facebook, a picture that said things I trust more than Obama. And there was a list of about 10 or 12 different things. And so I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put this posting on my sign out front of the office. And every few days, I'll change it up so that it says something else new that was on the list that was originally sent to me. So we did modify it a little bit because I only have so much room on the sign. There's only so many letters I can put up. So the first week we had last week we had one thing, and then we changed it middle of the week, and this week while I was out of town, actually, my nephew, who I asked to change the sign, gave him the list of what to put on there. He put the sign on there, and that's what's up there now and will remain on there until Wednesday.
And how long has it been up?
You know what? I don't know what day he actually changed it, because like I said, I was traveling. I was in San Diego and Tijuana, Mexico last week. So I would guess that it went up Friday or Saturday.
All right.
But didn't raise any eyebrows,
until
at least publicly, until yesterday afternoon.
No phone calls to your business?
Not until yesterday afternoon.
You say, now you realize, and you say it's going to stay up until Wednesday.
Tomorrow.
Till tomorrow. Somebody, I think, on Facebook said you should take it down now, and I think your response was it's going to go down on Wednesday when it's scheduled to go down.
Yep.
If you realize now, and you're saying you didn't mean to offend anyone,
correct,
but obviously you have, why wouldn't you take it down immediately?
I'm sticking to my free speech. As a United States citizen, I have the right to free speech, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, yeah, you do, and you, I guess, suffer the consequences. You have customers and community members, many of whom are well-respected, have served on councils or boards of education, and they're all saying, this is not what we want in our community. This is hateful speech. Do you not respect them?
I respect some of them, yes. First of all, I can say that out of the names that I've looked at that have sent me hateful messages on Facebook and people that are calling, they're not my customers. There are people in the community who – that's their position in the community, to try to improve the community. And I don't have a problem with them. They have their right to free speech just as much as I do. It's not my customers that are complaining. My customers aren't the ones that are sending me these hateful messages. It's people who are speaking for my customers, and maybe they're speaking for my customers, and maybe they're not really speaking the voice of my customers. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I know customers who will not use you now.
And that could be. And they have every right to use Red Top or Bloomington Normal Cab. Let's hit the bell so they get them a little public.
Yeah.
There we go.
Ding. Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the Not In Our Town effort?
Yeah.
Do you agree with it?
With Not In Our Town?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think this is a race issue. This is a joke. This is a joke.
Right.
You know,
but
I read this.
But it's a joke against a race.
Okay, but when I read this article on Facebook, and I was telling Scott outside in the hallway, and I've told people from WEK News and Channel 31, whatever it is, MBD, yesterday, that when I read this, the first thing I thought of was Indiana Jones being chased on a motorcycle, and here comes a Palestinian
on a motorcycle. But that's what you thought of.
Yes.
What if I'm Palestinian and I'm offended? Like,
then you have every
you
right to be offended.
Right, but you don't care about that?
I think that that number of persons that would be offended is very small, or at least
so
I
it doesn't
so.
Matter how many people are offended, or
well, I don't,
if it's five, that's
so you're,
okay.
Basically,
if it's
you're,
10, it's
you're
not
willing
enough.
To put your money where your mouth is, and
correct.
If you lose some business,
then I lose some business
over what you consider a joke.
Aaron, here's what I don't get.
Here's what I don't get.
You say you agree with Not In Our Town. Do you know what that's about? Do you know what that campaign is about?
I have heard of it. I have heard of it. I don't know 100% what it is. I know, obviously, it's people that don't want people bashing different ethnic groups or different cultures.
I can read you the pledge.
I'm married to a Filipino.
I know. I'm just saying.
I have employees or drivers who are different ethnic races. I pledge money to different organizations in town. I support a lot of ethnic organizations in town. To me, this is no different than the old Polak joke.
But does this make it right? Doesn't matter all the other things that you've done. You've done something that people find offensive. Palestinians in this community who live here find offensive. Mm-hmm. When you do a search for Palestinian on a motorcycle, the top 10 results that come up are terrorists. It is a negative stereotype that now you're perpetuating.
I think what it goes to is I trust those terrorists more than I trust our president.
Okay. So now you're being ridiculous.
No,
now
you just
lost.
Just
no,
Colin, now Colin, let him talk.
Well, now you've lost credibility.
No, you just told me that if you Google and you do a search for the top 10, it's terrorists. The Palestinians on a motorcycle are terrorists. That's what you just said. And I'm saying that I trust those people more than I trust our president. Our president is a buffoon.
You trust terrorists more than our president.
What I'm saying is this whole thing was a joke. The whole thing was a joke.
But,
and our president,
you know, Aaron,
I have zero
faith
in.
There have been times that I've come out, and we all have, said something that got us in trouble. And once we realize that we offended somebody, you apologize. Because I've said things that I had in no way intended on offending anyone.
Sure.
But then you get the calls and the emails.
Sure.
And you got to go up and save face.
And I did yesterday on Facebook. I wrote probably a 3 or 4 paragraph, I don't know.
But you defended your position. You didn't really apologize, and you're not taking the sign down.
I am tomorrow when it's due to come down.
What did you ever see?
So you're not reacting to people being offended. You're sticking to your guns.
Yes.
So when you were a little kid and you'd said something to offend another boy, and your parents said you should apologize for that, did you not apologize?
I did, and I did apologize yesterday on Facebook.
So do you want to apologize now?
I'll just say that when I put my sign up, I meant no offense to any Palestinians. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was humorous. I used to tell Polak jokes or short people jokes or whatever.
But that, yes.
And that's offensive to Polish people.
Yeah.
I know, but I don't see the Polish people causing an uprising, you know, and honestly, I'm not seeing the Palestinians an uprising here in Illinois.
Well, you would see an uprising of the Polish if you were to make your next sign offensive to the Poles.
The next sign is going to say gas station sushi, and I'm hoping we're not going to offend gas station owners or fishermen.
I just think you don't get it. I just don't think
it's
you get
joke.
It. I know.
I do get it. It's a joke.
And I get that, too. I get that you thought you were being funny. I understand that. But now when people are saying, you've offended me, you say, I'm sorry, but I'm keeping my sign up. It seems very insincere.
Well, I mean, he can apologize for I get where you're coming from. He's going to stick by his guns. It's a freedom of speech thing here, and we talk about it all the time. But people say, well, he's got this freedom of speech. Yes, he does, but he's going to have to pay the consequences.
Yep.
Now, we don't know what that means, really.
Sure.
Will business drop? Let me ask you this. Have you heard it from your drivers? Because you have drivers that, you know, if they go to another cab company or the ugly you, which is operating in this town illegally, but
yes.
If they were to do that, then it hurts your employees.
Correct.
You heard from them at all?
I've heard nothing but
not a single.
I've heard nothing but attaboys and way to goes from my drivers.
That was Checker cab owner Aaron Halliday with Scott and Colleen. Illinois Wesleyan professor Adriana Ponce taught music to Palestinian students in the West Bank for 5 years, and her son is a native-born Palestinian. She talked with WJBC's Terry James this week about the sign and whether she feels racism living in Bloomington.
You believe that you would know how this might be offensive to the Palestinian people, this sign in front of the cab company.
Yes, hopefully to the Palestinian people and to all people that believe in equality and are against stereotyping peoples and that kind of thing. Yeah.
And why is this sign offensive to you?
Well, you know, on the face of it, you might think at the beginning that it's a political statement and the guy is just telling us that he does not trust President Obama. And that, of course, would be a legitimate position. It would be much more useful if we knew why he doesn't trust President Obama. But when you move to the second part and you see the comparison with a Palestinian on a motorcycle, first of all, I very much doubt that he has met any Palestinians. But more importantly than that is that any Palestinian in a motorcycle represents all Palestinians in a motorcycle. So it's a gross generalization there. So all Palestinians are the same, basically, is the implication there. So the minute you go there, you realize that the guy is simply resorting to stereotypes and generalizations, and, of course, with a very negative element there, because the idea is that any and all Palestinians in a motorcycle are not trustworthy for whatever reason he imagines that to be the case.
Your son is Palestinian. Does he hold any of these views of wanting to hurt anyone?
But of course not. That's kind of a borderline offensive question. He and millions of Palestinians that I know are, you know, pacifists, very kind people, and people that do not hold any of these views. It's just ridiculous.
Sure, and I definitely mean no disrespect.
I know.
Yeah, trying to understand the sign is what, when I first heard the story, I'm just trying to think, What does this mean?
Well, I do have an idea. I mean, it is no secret that here at the national level, there is a tendency to demonize Palestinians and or Arabs and or Muslims. So people often feel entitled to, you know, just taking your pick and using any of these images, you know, for and all the stereotypes that they've acquired over the years for their own purposes. So that's the only light in which I can see this. It's just, it could have just been a Muslim or an Arab, which are often demonized in the press and everywhere else here. And that's how I read it.
Is it hard to be a, I mean, I know that you are Venezuelan. Do you believe it's difficult to be a Palestinian in Bloomington Normal?
Well, I know it is difficult to be a Palestinian in Bloomington Normal because I have my husband and my son who are recipients of all kinds of discrimination and abuse every now and then. And sometimes it kind of splashes onto me also, so I'm not completely free of that. However, it is it's not the worst place where I've been at all in this respect. So I found I've encountered these kind of situations in other places in the States as well. And I do think things are changing for the better, and I'm really, really grateful to the people that have the courage to stand up and fight discrimination and fight for equality and all that, because things are getting easier, and that's really reassuring and warming.
That was Illinois Wesleyan Professor Adriana Ponce with our Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It was 45 years ago this week that members of the Ohio National Guard fired on unarmed student protesters at Kent State University. Four people were killed and nine others injured seriously in what became known as the Kent State Massacre. Jim Russell was a journalism student there who now lives in Bloomington, and he was there when it happened. He talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Doesn't seem like it's been 45 years already.
You know, it doesn't, but you know, I'm old enough now to realize what the years mean, and, you know, some things stay with you, and I think certainly this memory does.
We're going to have you paint a little bit of the run-up to that day, because there was an awful lot going on, not just in Kent, but all across the country. But in Kent, there was a lot of it was really tense the days leading up to this, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was. I mean, probably started Thursday when President Nixon announced the incursion into Cambodia, and there was rallies. You know, there had been, you know, a lot of anti-war activities going on throughout the school year, but I think that fomented a lot of activity around the country, including Kent. And so there were rallies planned the very next day, and they were already prohibited. The guard was called in because of the possibility of violence and or, you know, the reaction to this. And of course that did occur almost immediately Friday night. I can remember being not really far from the front campus and being in a tear gas situation outside with no particular order or sequence of things, just a lot of chaos and a lot of tear gas clouds and flumes around wherever you went. There was really no escaping it if you were outside.
Jim Russell from Bloomington is with us. When did it move forward to the point where the two sides came head-to-head and bullets began flying?
Well, I think prior to any shots, there was an order given at some point to disperse the crowd, and somehow that was immediately followed by tear gas as a way to disperse thousands of people who were in this area. It wasn't very effective. The tear gas certainly has an effect, but if in this case, I would say it was mostly an agitating effect. And whether people were there, as I said earlier, to participate or to observe, everyone got involved at that point. It became very, very belligerent. The attitude just became very belligerent, and I think there was basically the Commons was kind of like I said, ringed by these guardsmen, jeeps, etc., and they started moving closer to try to force people to move in one direction or another. And so people were. However, there were some people that were just confronting, and there was at some point, and I wouldn't say within an hour of this. Of this confrontation, maybe even less, there was a contingent of troopers, guardsmen that went up over this hill behind a building that overlooked this area, and that's where the shootings occurred. There's a dispute as to whether or not there was an order given or whether this was a simultaneous action, but there is film to show that they literally all knelt down at the same time and opened fire.
Where were you exactly when this whole the shooting actually began?
I was on the in the commons area, so I was on the other side of that building. It was a building I used often. I was a journalism student, and that's where the campus newspaper was housed, along with I think the School of Architecture. So I was certainly in the thick of it. I heard the gunshots. I didn't see the shootings themselves, but it quickly and it quite. I have to say, I wasn't familiar with what an M1 would sound like, but it went on for about 13 seconds, so it was quite a volley of shots. And at first, you might have assumed it was fireworks or something. I don't think anybody really thought immediately that there were, you know, that it was gunfire. But it almost shortly thereafter, people are running and people are just running in every direction, and you see people either covered in blood or have. You know, some evidence and people screaming, you know, they're shooting and it became rather chaotic at that point. Nobody knew what to do, including the guardsmen. I mean, they were the majority who were still in that commons area, you know, were just, you know, didn't know what to do at that point either.
You were on the other side of the building where this happened. How long was it before you came around to where the shootings had actually taken place?
Well, I think people were at that point were circulating only for safety at that point. So it was, it became rather somewhat restricted just because of the people wanting to escape that area. Some people running to that area, but only in terms of first aid and or first responders. So and certainly nobody wanted to continue to be targets. So I think for the most part, most of us stayed within the site, within, you know, but not wanting to penetrate the range of what that became.
When you look back at that day, what are the sights and the sounds, the smells, I'm betting, that you can bring back just as plainly as they happened yesterday?
Well, you know, at that point, shouts became screams. I guess that would be one way to translate it. And then screaming became just weeping, sobbing, and just disbelief. You know, as naive as it may sound, the fact that guardsmen had been there all weekend, the fact that they've been, you know, carrying weapons with bayonets fixed to these weapons and had basically been very omnipresent. And the fact that, you know, we'd been through tear gas and demonstrations, et cetera, I think at that point it became all too real. I don't think anybody knew that there were, you know, as I said earlier, we apparently didn't think they would use weapons. Didn't even probably even think they had bullets. But, in hindsight, what a naive notion. So as far as the tone, it became almost nobody was in control at that point, but everybody was just absolutely scared to death.
That was Jim Russell of Bloomington describing the Kent State Massacre with our Dan Swaney. And it was a dream come true for James O'Shaughnessy this week. The former Illinois State tight end heard his name called in the NFL draft, taken in the fifth round by the Kansas City Chiefs. The Naperville native talked with WJBC's Tim Lewis this week.
What was it like on draft day for you?
Well, draft day was really exciting. Obviously, it's a little nerve-wracking because you're not sure where you're going to go or if you're going to go at all. But I was just very extremely fortunate to be able to get an opportunity to work with the Chiefs and be a part of their organization. To tell the truth, most of the day was kind of a quiet day. I didn't have a big draft party or anything like that. I just had a few friends and family over. And fortunately, throughout the fifth round, you started seeing some tight ends go off the board, which was a good sign. And we knew once I got to a certain number of tight ends, hopefully my name would get called. But sadly, I wasn't hearing from any teams, so it was kind of bizarre. And then in the fifth round, I won 70. I get a call from Coach Reed, and he says he's going to take me in the next couple of picks, 173rd pick, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I actually wasn't even able to see it come across the board. My family saw it before I did because I was on the phone with the tight ends coach, Coach Melvin, OC, a couple other player personnel people. So when it happened, I had people screaming in the background, and it was a great feeling. And I couldn't be happier to be a part of such a great organization and play for such a great coach.
Plenty of still shots of the draft board out there on the internet you can probably capture and keep because it looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
See your name up there in lights. Naperville kid, was there a pull maybe to want to play for the Bears?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, obviously. Being a Chicago fan, I've grown up idolizing every Bears tight end I've ever seen, Greg Olsen, Martellus Bennett over the recent years, but I would have loved to play for the Bears, and if it would have came down to free agency, they could have probably sold me on that, being a hometown guy. But luckily, we have another Redbird who's a Bear, or has the opportunity to make the Bears roster in Cam Meredith, so I'll still be supporting them from Kansas City.
Well, you know, anytime Redbird gets drafted, it is big news, and certainly we have a lot of high wishes for a lot of other your teammates who probably will be signing free agent contracts and have a shot to stick somewhere. You don't get time to rest. You've got, are you reporting? First day of practice for you guys is the 10th, is that right?
That's the first day I have to report. I know the first couple days down there will be mostly meetings and lifting, and then we'll get to rookie mini camp. But actually, I have to stay down there all the way through mid-July, so a lot of other people get to come home after rookie mini camp, but I don't, which I'm actually looking forward to. I think it'd be a good thing to get acclimated with my new home and my new teammates and team. But it's going to be a pretty hectic summer, a very difficult summer, and I'm excited for the challenge. Obviously, that's what we've all lived. All Redbird football players, any football player who's got fortunate enough to be in my place and my opportunity, are just excited to get this opportunity to compete at the highest level possible, and that's what I'm just truly excited to do.
You know, you've had the last 3 years with the Redbirds. When you first put on the Redbird uniform to where you stand today, you're now an NFL player. I guess we should qualify that. You will soon be once you put on that helmet. But is it surreal? I mean, has it sunk in yet, or is it's going to take actually putting that uniform on?
I think it's going to take. Once I get to the facilities and see my name up on that locker, I think that'll be the first day when it really sinks in. But obviously, it's hit me a little bit, and I'm at a loss for words a lot of the times because I never, like you said, I wouldn't. Never 5 years ago would have expected that I'd have this opportunity coming in as a wide receiver, making the transition to tight end, having success throughout my career, being very fortunate to be a part of two playoff runs in the Redbird history, and to now be have an opportunity to continue my career is just a blessing. And I just it's really difficult to describe in a lot of terms, even though it's you can always hit the cliches. It's exciting. I'm happy as I've ever been. And I am because it's just an unbelievable feeling and experience.
James, obviously there's a lot of nervousness that goes along with being an NFL player. I'm sure that you're feeling that. Is there a little bit of added stress, though, knowing that you're going to the Kansas City Chiefs, which was home to quite possibly the greatest tight end of all time?
He's subjective.
I wouldn't say stress, one, because I grew up actually watching the Kansas City Chiefs because of Tony Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. I would not say stressed because I'm more excited about it. Obviously, it's going to be difficult. Obviously, I'm going to have my rough days. But in the end of it, you still get an opportunity to play football as your career, as your job. And that opportunity itself will get me through the tough times. I will never forget where I came from and never forget how fortunate I am to be in that position. So those days when I do feel nervous about something and struggling of some sort, I know I'm just fortunate enough to be in this opportunity. And all I want to do is make the most of it. And at the end of the day, you just got to live with yourself and know that you gave it all, which I plan to do.
Who was the first person from ISU to contact you after you were drafted? Did the coach call you yet?
Yeah, I talked to Coach Spack. I talked to Coach McClain, my tight end coach. I talked to couple other tight ends coaches that have been over here, Coach Williams, Coach Cross, along with many others. Boomer Grisby actually reached out to me, and I really appreciated that. I grew up a big fan of his. And obviously, he called some of my games over this last year and years as a Redbird, but he has had a lot of nice things to say. And he was a chief for a while, so he gave me some pointers and told me some things to look forward to, the barbecue, things like that. And over the last couple of days, I've heard from every other coach I've had. I got to give a special thanks to the whole Naperville community. My high school coaches, they were very influential in my career, along with Coach Spack and the coach at ISU. So it's just been great hearing from everybody. I've kept in contact with most of them over the years, but some I haven't, so it's even better to be able to thank them for what the opportunity I've gotten.
It's had to be a humbling year. I mean, last year, to finish up your final season with the Redbirds the way you guys did, especially those games in the playoffs where you just beat team after team after team that was supposed to beat you guys, but you found the resolve and certainly dug down for that brotherhood to get done what needed to be done. It must have been tremendous to get as far as you did. I know you didn't get what you wanted, but what a season for you guys.
Yeah, obviously it didn't end how we wanted it to, but now looking back after having a couple time off and I'm really getting to think about how the great strides we made as a team, as a program, because I've been there since, I think I was part of Coach Spack's first recruiting class. I've seen the turnover. I've seen the struggles we had when we were 5-6 after making the playoff run the year before. To be a part of that senior class, because I really want to emphasize that senior group. I don't think we're pick sixth in that conference that
yes.
year.
Yeah.
And believe me, I won't ever forget that, and I don't think any other teams will, because we took that as a sign of disrespect that we, as a group, as a whole, weren't capable to take the team where we knew we were capable to do it. And to reach the promised land, as you want to say it, or the championship game, it was unbelievable, and it would be something that I'll never forget. It was obviously not only the greatest thing in my career, but the most exciting time from my life, my family's life, my friend's life. Everybody who was all the ex-Redbirds who were able to come down and support us at the game. It's just awesome.
That was NFL draftee and former Redbird James O'Shaughnessy with our Tim Lewis. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Bloomington has taken a step toward revitalizing its downtown as the council this week gave a preliminary okay to continue talks with the developer Jeff Geibelhausen on a plan that involves the demolition of four downtown properties. But what would replace those properties is still unknown.
The exciting point is it opens up the entire development world to say we've got a dream for that property, we've got an idea. So I'm not going to narrow it down and say what it might be. Might it be mixed use? Might it be retail with office? Might it be retail with office with residential? Might it be hotel with retail? It becomes a blank canvas.
What is known is the price of the project, an estimated $8.2 million, which would likely come from borrowed funds and bonds. The council has a little more than a month to form a plan and set a timeline for the project if the city wishes to proceed. Tuition at Illinois State University will rise next year, but by how much is not known. The school's Board of Trustees has presented two options for tuition increases, either a 4% hike or 6% for new students next year. The uncertainty is because the legislature hasn't passed a budget yet. ISU President Larry Diet says students shouldn't have to bear the brunt of a reduction in state aid, and any potential cuts would come first from what he calls the non-human aspects of the university.
We would defer maintenance on projects that we've already deferred maintenance on, but we wouldn't do some of that work at the first place that we would start. But quickly you move into the human part of that, and those are positions. And so the way we would start that is that we would look at vacant positions and any potential for not filling vacant positions.
Deed says a special board meeting will likely be called later this month to pass a tuition increase. Illinois House Democrats have sent a clear message to Governor Rauner that they are not on board with his plans to slash human services funding in next year's budget. They voted unanimously against Governor Rauner's $11 billion measure that would cut Medicaid and reduce mental health and addiction treatment programs. The entire Republican caucus voted present. And representatives like Forsyth Republican Bill Mitchell were upset the bills didn't go through House committees first.
This is horrible politics. It's not fair to seniors. It's not fair to people with Alzheimer's. It's not fair with people's autism. It's not fair with for people with disabilities. I'm mad. I'm disappointed. We deserve better.
House Speaker Michael Madigan says the vote was intended to facilitate consideration of next year's budget. And Normal's Town Council has approved extending a program that provides rebates on the town's portion of the sales tax when residents buy an electric vehicle. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports.
The approval did come with some dissenting opinions as two councilmen voted no. Councilman Jeff Fritzen was one of them.
I just think with the recent placing a tax, local tax on gas consumption and with our revenue situation the way it is, I don't think this is a revenue that we need to be giving up. Like I said, I think it's accomplished the purpose that it was set out to do.
Councilman Scott Preston also voted against extending the program, which will now go through the end of 2016. City Manager Mark Peterson says the average rebate to citizens has been around $300. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday night, Bloomington's City Council will hold its first meeting since swearing in its new council. The city will look to establish a budget task force. On Wednesday, District 87 will hold its final board meeting of the school year. And on Friday, the Normal Corn Belters will open a new season, playing in St. Charles, Missouri, against the River City Rascals. WJBC will bring you select Normal Corn Belters games this season. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.